Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash-Burnett.
Welcome to a special live edition of Berlin Inside Out, the Foreign Affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations, which is undergoing a very special name change during our time at the Leonard Meri Conference in Tallinn in honor of our Estonian hosts and taking full advantage of the opportunity that the name of the Estonian capital affords us, of course. Welcome to Tallinn Inside Out. Thank you, everyone, our fabulous hosts at Leonard Meri, our live audience, and our amazing guests for joining us, two of whom are joining us momentarily. I'm Aaron Gash-Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German and European politics. And as always, I'm here with my friend and co-host Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Ben, we have come to Tallinn from Berlin. And in Berlin, we had plenty of gloomy discussions earlier this week, and they were laced with, unfortunately, a lot of fatalism, resignation, despair over our current moment in European security and prosperity. He's nodding his head there. We heard plenty about the threat that Russia poses to Ukraine and to all of us. And I know that you and I both left many of those discussions with the feeling of, well, hey, we can still do something about this. We still have viable solutions for support Ukraine, and in so doing, securing ourselves, we can step up European military support. We can seize Russia's frozen central bank assets. There's still a lot of things that we can do, so let's talk about those. Why aren't we doing that? And that's a big part of why it's amazing to be here in Tallinn and at this conference, which this year really felt like it was speaking exactly to that feeling that I just described right now that we were having earlier this week with its main theme, let us not despair, but act. Some of us were just at a briefing with Prime Minister Kallas, who encouraged us that while we need to be aware of how serious the situation is, we also need to avoid being overly pessimistic because pessimism can lead to inaction. So let's look at our options, because where there are options, there is hope.
That's right, because I think sometimes we need to be able to say, let us act, lest we despair. We need to actually not wallow in pessimism or panic at the scale of the challenge we face. But at the same time, we also need to be clear-eyed about the threats we face and the dangers that we're actually in. And it's striking that balance in order to inspire action rather than prevent it that we convened this panel today. And I'm very happy to say we've been joined by real experts who are going to provide their different perspectives on this. But as Aaron mentioned, the case for despair is certainly easy to make if you're in Berlin. It's a little harder to make if you're in Tallinn. And so understanding these different strategic conversations, the different outlook and the different approach, and how that's actually affecting our ability to act and act strategically is why we wanted to convene this discussion today. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that we've been pursuing an approach to grand strategy for liberal democracies that we call neo-idealism. And at the core of that is the notion that actually liberal democracy's key advantage over our systemic competitors is the right to a hopeful future for our citizens. And it's restoring that credibility of hope that we see as essential to actually restoring our credibility of strategic action. There are, of course, obstacles to doing that. This is no easy task. And it's no coincidence that the quote that inspired the theme of this year's Leonard Meri Conference was taken from then-Senator John Kennedy at a time of great global tension, at a time of deep into the first Cold War, when he said, "Let us not despair, but act."
First up, actually, as we heard yesterday amidst a conversation of favorites, is, you heard it here actually, is one of Kaja Kallas's favorite historians. That is, of course, Timothy Snyder, who just walked in, professor of history and global affairs at Yale University and co-founder of Documenting Ukraine, the recipient of many distinctions across many countries, the author of 20 books, in addition to the many hats that he wears. We also have Elliot Cohen, one of the world's foremost experts on strategy, the Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for International Studies. And also joining us is Ana Isabel Xavier, Secretary of State at the Portuguese Ministry of National Defense, a position she recently took up following a storied career in public service and security. And we are also excited to be welcoming Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tsahkna a little bit later in the show.
Tim, thanks very much for running in straight from the airport. Great to have you with us. You've been one of the most clear-eyed voices for understanding the threats to democracy that we currently face. What are those threats, and how, despite those, can we still draw hope?
Goodness, first of all, it's great to be here, and I promise to shave before the next time you see me. I started my day at 4 o'clock, and I have just walked into the hotel room, and I'm very happy to be in the presence of hosts of the podcast and colleagues. Threats to democracy, number one, is complacency. Historically speaking, democracy is always incredibly difficult and exceptional. And therefore, any idea that democracy is the end of history or is brought to us by a constitution or by national exceptionalism or any nonsense of that sort is deadly dangerous for democracy. Related to that, or another way to put that same point is that nihilism is a threat to democracy. So democracy is not a state of affairs. It's a desire. It's an aspiration. No one's ever had perfect democracy. And so insofar as your society is being voided of ethical direction, you're not going to end up as a democracy because the people have to want to rule and they have to want to rule for reasons. In terms of what you were probably asking about, maybe more pragmatic things, the two that I would always mention would be a social media structure, which directs us towards a kind of hyper-individualistic atomization, and which instructs us that people who don't agree with us are not just of different views, but are the enemy. And related to that, actually, radical income inequality, and especially inequality of wealth, which makes it difficult for people to believe that they actually belong to the same group as everyone else.
Elliot, how do we go about turning that situation then into strategic action?
Well, first, again, also delighted to be part of this podcast and with such distinguished colleagues. I think the most important thing at the moment, because you know, let's remember we're focused on the war in Ukraine, is, as the French would say, à la guerre comme à la guerre, that if you're at a war, you better treat it like a war. And the fact of the matter is our societies, even including the United States, which has been engaged in more wars than most, doesn't really fully grasp what the kind of war that Ukraine is waging. And we are not yet taking it with the seriousness that it requires. It is not enough to say, you know, we're with Ukraine for as long as it takes. You know, you really have to be thinking much more concretely, and that involves action. I mean, I have to say I'm very skeptical of any solution that is primarily about speech. It's ultimately about numbers. It's about, you know, are you willing to relax the various restrictions and regulations you have so you can build more arms factories and run them 24 hours a day and be willing to take risks and say, yeah, we're willing to have a TACMs hit targets in Russia and we're willing to get the German government to send Taurus and a whole bunch of other things. But for my chief concern at the moment is because war is so remote from our societies that we have trouble grappling with what succeeding in it requires. And if I could say one more thing, I think the despair part is overwrought. This is what wars are like. You go through periods where you think you're being very successful and then you suffer stunning reverses and the war goes on. You have to steel yourself to deal with that. And there's a kind of mental toughness that is required of societies and above all of leaders to get us through it. And I would say that is in many ways the most urgent requirement at the moment.
I just wanted to connect, if I could, what Elliot was saying to a point I was trying to make, that if democracy is always going to be a matter of some kind of ethical choice, that ethical choice is always going to involve risk, which is an argument that the Greeks made quite rightly. And one way to characterize, I think, what Elliot was trying to say is that we, in these societies we characterize as democracies, we tend to think that the work is being done by somebody else or something else, some set of institutions, some inheritance, maybe capitalism. And that way of thinking about it dulls us to the reality that everybody is taking risks if there's going to be a democracy, more or less risk. And it makes it harder for us to admire the people who are taking the most risk. And in order to be democratic now, one has to be in a position sort of psychologically and morally to admire the Ukrainians because they are taking the most risk, as opposed to resenting them because they're doing things that maybe you couldn't do, or resenting them because you think somehow they're the cause of your problems, or resenting them because they somehow get in the way of your view that everything should just kind of work out on its own.
Well, we saw this very much in the famous in Germany, at least, the Emma letter that was sent by a group of intellectuals in the first year of the war. And it became quite clear quite quickly that their main objection is that the Ukrainians' courage had shone the light on their cowardice and their unwillingness to actually stand up for the liberal democratic values from which they benefit in their own societies every day. And that's the kind of cynicism that I think has come from a despair that actually predates the Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and reflects a deeper pessimism in some of our societies. We see these surveys that are done about, do you think your kids are going to live better than you do? Do you think the next generation is going to have it better? And the last iteration of this from Pew in the US was that 4 out of 5 Americans don't think it's getting better. They think it's going to get worse. We've seen this in a consistent trend since the 1970s in the West, with a couple of peaks for 1989, for example. But those who've been able to actually articulate positive visions, Aaron, have those who've been able to act as well, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, well, it's no secret that you and I love being here. And one of the reasons for that is that this is a part of the world where the concept of neo-idealism that you've articulated a lot of principles thereof is alive and well here. The very theme of this conference, Let Us Not Despair But Act, is already an example of this. We see here resolute commitments to defend democracy where it is threatened, but also as well a self-confidence in democracy and the value of free societies that I think many of us can learn a lot from and emulate. So just a few examples, Kaja Kallas herself even, Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielis Landsbergis, former Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin are all examples of people who exhibited this sort of self-confidence. But neo-idealists can be found everywhere, and they do come from all democratic political traditions, from social democrats to Greens, liberals to conservatives. And with that in mind, Anna, I'd like to ask you, who are the self-confident neo-idealists of Southern Europe or elsewhere that you draw inspiration from?
By which we mean, who are those who can combine rhetoric, as Elliot said, with action? Who can put their material support where their mouth is? And just a couple of examples from this region to sort of connect to what you might want to say. We see that the rhetorical support for Ukraine and for standing up for liberal democracy from the figures that Aaron just mentioned has been matched by material support in terms of GDP percentages spent on defense. Estonia is up to 3.2% plus 0.25% of GDP for Ukraine, but also on doubling down on what it means to be a liberal society. So Estonia's recognition of gay marriage, understanding that if you want to beat the drum for a liberal approach to international politics, you need to be liberal at home too. And we can see that also in the consolidation of Ukraine's civic nationhood at a time when they are saying that this is part of a wider struggle for democracy against tyranny. They've understood very clearly that they also have to live up to that themselves. And it's in the magazine Diplomatia that's handed around for the conference. There's a piece that also talks about the historical anomaly of democracy's dominance came from democracies being at their best. And we've lost a bit of that winning mentality. So these people, we think, are trying to get it back and trying to actually get on the front foot and do the things that need to be done. We talk about this region a lot, Anna, but where is it happening in Southern Europe?
Thank you so much, Benjamin, Haran, Elliot, and Timothy. It's a pleasure. Good afternoon to all the audience. Well, Lisbon is 4,000 kilometers away from Tallinn. So geography is what it is. But although we are a southern country and our concerns are mostly with the southern flank, we are fully committed with the eastern geography and with the eastern challenges. And we are fully committed with Ukraine since day one. And that is very important for us because we are aware that democracy or the concept of liberal democracy that also Aaron already spoke about is at stake when we are talking about making Ukraine prevail and making the sovereignty of Ukraine prevail. Portugal is a small country in terms of extent, but we definitely punch above our weight. Our military assistance package so far is around 125 million euro. And we also cooperate with initiatives that are already ongoing, like the initiative from Czechia on the ammunition with 100 million and other joint procurement acquisition munitions, for instance, within framework contracts, European Defense Agency, and many other initiatives that we feel are very important. Not only because what it is at stake, but because it really commits Portugal to this broader idea on how democracy must prevail and on how democracy is part of our collective ability to act strategically. We are completely committed within NATO, within the European Union, United Nations, but also the Portuguese-speaking language countries. And that is important for us because Portugal perceives itself as a bridge with Brazil, with the African countries. And we also perceive ourselves has been in a privileged position to speak to, but most important to listen to the South, but also to bridge the Eastern challenges to the Southern concerns. The fact that, for instance, Russia is in fact a major challenge in Africa as well, and also in the Portuguese-speaking countries. And Portugal is really struggling with this challenge in Africa, helping other countries such as Estonia to bridge their concerns in the South as well. So that's why it's so important for a country like Portugal to be present at Leonard Merritt and be part of this discussion, and also to emphasize how liberal democracy is all about not to despair, but to act, and to act strategically, and in our case, absolutely, in the multilateral environment.
So you've just mentioned, Anna, that democracy is integral to acting strategically. And part of that is the right to a better future, to a more prosperous future, to a more hopeful future. And Margus Tsahkna has just joined us, Estonian foreign minister here. And you just came from Georgia, where people are demonstrating for this exact right, the right to a hopeful future. So what lessons did you take from that? And what kind of strategic action can we take to support that as democracies?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm really happy to be here. And sorry, I was a bit late, but I really, literally, I just arrived to Estonia right now from Georgia through the Strasbourg, and we had this Council of Europe meeting. The question was that what can we learn from that? And I'm thinking that we don't have to learn anything from the situation right now, what is happening in Georgia, because we knew it will come. But we have to learn about the situations what we have had already in Georgia, or what we had in Ukraine, because Georgia was occupied 2008, and we didn't learn anything from that, to be honest. We didn't act, we didn't react, and we were hoping that, business as usual will continue. It's very bad. We were deeply concerned, and more deeply concerned. Then we had Ukraine 2014, and we didn't really, really react in the proper ways. So now we have a full-scale military aggression in Ukraine. I'm not going to describe you know very well what is going on. And we have many other conflicts. And the question is what we have learned about this. What we have learned about this. And I'm thinking maybe nothing. And the price is going higher and higher. And the price, finally, it's not paid for any other nation anymore, which is not in NATO or EU. But the price is, we are going to pay this price ourselves, because freedom, democracy, rule of law, maybe we understand finally, it is not granted. It's not granted. We have to fight for that. We have to fight for that. And business as usual never comes back anymore. But I'm very honest, I see it daily, if I'm traveling, if I'm meeting our people, our different politicians from different like-minded countries, that there is like a wishful thinking that the business as usual returns. But it's not. So from Georgia, I'm saying really, it's not just an emotions, because I just came from there. But the situation is really, 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 really concerning. And the Georgian government words and actions are not, they're not fitting together. So we had a meetings with the prime minister, president, speaker, foreign minister, but also the opposition leaders, and as well the third sector and NGOs. And it's not a question only about the law, the Russian law they call, but what is going on? What is behind that? Actually, I think that the Georgian government is taking steps towards the Russian influence. But what they're trying to act is that they're doing like both things. They're using the fear of people who are still remembering the price they paid when Russia made an aggression, 20% of the territory still occupied, and addressing people that we are keeping the peace. We are keeping the peace, don't worry. And at the same time, we are following your will. You know, more than 80%, 86-87% now, Georgian people, they want to join European Union, moving towards NATO and EU. And we are following your wish and actually acting, and now I can say as well, pretending that they are fulfilling the promises they have given actually as well to European Union when they actually gain the position as an official candidate country. And these talks and rhetorics and reality is not fitting together. So we don't have to learn anything from Georgia right now. We have to learn from everything what we have witnessed and what is going on. What I want to say, if we are not acting right now, and if we are even more deeply concerned about Georgian situation, then we are going to lose Georgia. So we need to act right now, not learning anything, but just act the right act. And that's my very clear message.
Margus, thank you for those clear words. And also, you were very clear pushing back against the speaker's report of your meeting, for example, which was not quite as you recalled it, I think.
Yeah, it was not amazing, actually, but somehow. But we saw that after the meeting, we left to... I was not alone. We were together with the Lithuanian, Latvian and Iceland foreign ministers. But the big press conference was organized, but not without us. So we were expecting anything. But honestly said, I didn't expect that this lie will be so big, that we really were very frank. And we said what we are thinking and what is the position. And EU has fulfilled all the promises what we have given, but not the Georgian government. And there will be consequences. And there will be consequences. And we are raising these questions on EU level anyways. But the outcome was, yes, different, that the speaker announced that we agreed everything. So then we had to, you know, say publicly as well that this was a lie. But the question is not about that. And one more fact, that I just, you know, arrived to Estonia and I read that we went there to take down the Georgian government. It was not, it's total lie in the meaning. And we participated with mass rallies, peaceful mass rallies. I think the largest ever happened in Georgia. I've been there many, many times before. And peaceful, what I want to say. And we said exactly the same things on the stage that Georgian government is saying, that the Georgian people's rightful place is in the EU. Nothing more. And to criticize because of that us, I think that the masks, they are falling right now. So we have to be very careful what is going on.
Thank you, Margus. Tim, in a second, I'm going to come to you on sources of our domestic division and how we might address those. Because what we see in Georgia is something akin to a revolution of dignity, I think, much like we saw on the streets in Kyiv back in 2013, 2014. People striving for this right to a hopeful future, striving to live in liberal democratic societies. But Elliot, I'd like to come to you first on how we can actually act to support that, how the international coalition of the free world can actually act to effectively support people striving for freedom?
Well, I don't think you can answer it as a general proposition. I mean, it depends what country you're talking about, what the circumstances are. And, you know, in the case of Georgia, it's probably, in addition to, you know, providing various kind of sort of emotional support, I suppose, and, you know, the kinds of things that intelligence agencies do, a lot of that is also about twisting the arms of the government and making clear to the individuals who are in charge in Georgia that they will pay a price in terms of how we will deal with them afterwards. I mean, I really want to, in a way, I want to go back to the premise of what you were saying, because I'm not sure I agree with it. You talk about an liberal international order. We haven't had a liberal international order. We had an international order that was constructed by the democratic side of the coalition that won World War II. It was largely, not by no means entirely, American, certainly American-led. And it had all kinds of problems with it, and it was morally inconsistent and so on and so forth. That order is now under assault. And it's not about abstract rules. It's something, you know, much more tangible than that. And I've, you know, to build that order, we had to do a lot of very hard things, a lot of very coercive things. We had to fight a bunch of wars, some of which were probably unwise. We had to spend a hell of a lot of money on defense at a level that is unimaginable for most states today. I mean, even, You know, you look at Poland, which is spending 4% of GDP. At the height of the Cold War, the United States was spending 8% of GDP and even at one point got almost as high as 10%. The question is, are you willing to do those very hard things in order to defend an international order that is cracking? And frankly, that's the kind of thing that I think will encourage people who are fighting, you know, in places like Georgia, and certainly in places like Ukraine, for the right to be free and self-governing.
Yeah, I think that's something that our regular listeners will know we would very much subscribe to that point of view. And it's about actually understanding that, sure, by its own high standards that it set, the liberal international order may not have been that liberal. By the standard of practically every other order in history, as Dan Nexon of Georgetown's pointed out, it was pretty damn liberal. And it was indeed an international order that was built together with allies. And just to give one example to what you're saying, recently it's been pointed out by Paul Mason, the British journalist and politician, that in the late 1930s, the UK was spending about 3.2% of GDP on defense. Fearing the war would come, they rose it up to 6.8% of GDP. Now, that wasn't enough. And they ended up spending nearly 50% of their GDP on defense. This is the kind of saving we can't actually afford to make if we're serious about deterring the threats to that order. At the same time, Tim, we see that there have been shortcomings of that order. We see that it wasn't necessarily serving the interests of liberal democracies when we let it become a legacy order of institutions without spirit. Perhaps we saw the United Nations instrumentalized by actors such as Russia and by China to advance distinctly illiberal goals. And at home, you mentioned before, we see divisions in our society, economic but cultural as well.
I think what the specific divisions are is a little bit less important than how they get generated and how one gets over them, which I think is at the bottom of your question. It connects to Georgia and it connects to Maidan. What people were interested in Maidan, and I have a feeling this is true in Georgia too, is the future, but not the future in just some abstract way, like not just one future, but the possibility that each of us can have unpredictable individual futures, which ultimately is what freedom is all about. Freedom is not a collective thing. And it's that kind of action, collective action towards the possibility of individual futures, which I think begins to shine a light in the general direction of an answer to your question. And that's why we see again and again, when people are deprived of a sense of future, this is how they act, right? This is how they act in Georgia. This is how they can act in the United States. In a few months, we'll see. But this is the normal human reaction. Not that everybody knows what the right future is, but that we want to create a situation in which we can imagine, like a kind of positive friction, horizontal connections, right? And that's why also The part in the Russian playbook that you play at this time is what the Georgians are calling the Russian law, the anti-civil society law, the foreign agent law, which is precisely designed to make any kind of cooperation seem like a bad thing, right? So, and where does the future get consumed? So when Russia invades Ukraine, Putin exemplifies one way the future gets consumed, which is to say, all that really matters is my own idiotic myth about the past. And I'm going to substitute my own idiotic myth about the past, my own entirely indefensible version of what happened in Kievan Rus in the 10th century for everybody's future, right? We're going to turn politics all the way back to the past. On my bad days, I'll turn it back to 1945. On my good days, all the way back to 988. But there will be no future. And we have a similar problem in the West. We do that too sometimes. But also what we do is that we take the future, which has to be a little unpredictable and individuated, and we allow it to be consumed by idiotic oligarchical visions, right? So Putin is an idiotic oligarch, but he's not the only one, right? His idea that Ukraine, it doesn't exist, is one of a species of stupid ideas that billionaires have, which tend to consume the future, right? So for example, we're going to all live in space, or we're all going to live forever, right? And then everyone else has to talk about those ideas, and those few monopolistic or oligarchic privatized notions of the future consume what we all need, right? Because there's no, the thing is, in a democracy, there can't be a single answer to your question of what the future is going to be like. The key is that it enables the future, gives people a sense that there's going to be a future. If I was going to name one thing which distinguishes where we are now from where we were in 1945 or 1948, it would be that in 1945 and 1948, we did not know that we were living in a post-imperial world. That order was still an imperial order, right? It was in the years and decades after 1945 that it became clear to most people anyway that empire was unsustainable. The European Union didn't know it, but what it is a post-imperial order. The Portuguese and the Spanish, you know, they didn't know that a quarter century later they were going to lose their empires and join a European project, right? De Gaulle didn't know they were going to lose in Algeria, and so on and so forth. The Dutch didn't know they were going to lose in Indonesia. Most of the examples of countries that joined the European Union are post-imperial one way or another. The East European examples are coming out of an empire, but that's also post-imperial. We all know now that we're in a post-imperial world, and in that sense, empire is the problem, right? Whether it's Russia or whether it's China. And the idea of being post-imperial can also tilt you towards the future, because you can ask, okay, how can you make a better America now that we know that the way to make America better is not to recreate an imperial America or a colonial America, right? So the idea that we're all in a post-imperial world now can help us define what's wrong, but can also open up the conversation about where you might go.
That's brilliantly put, and I agree with it. But I guess I would also like to point out that I think, you know, we have a tendency to believe that, well, this order was created in 1945 and everything was sort of fine until Putin invaded Ukraine. And that's really not true. First, it was a partial order. You know, the Soviet Union wasn't part of it. The Soviet Empire was not part of it. China was not part of it. You know, you had all of the kind of imperial post-colonial upheavals that were associated with it. It was a very, very challenging time. And I think that's really the critical thing to remember, is that the problem that we've had is what my late colleague Fuad Ajami once called the Great Picnic, which is how he referred to the period after 1991. He said, we've been living through the Great Picnic, when the world seemed wide open. You know, you could find a Starbucks in Mongolia. You have the shock of 9/11, but there was still a sense that we had exited the world of war. We had Francis Fukuyama in The End of History, that there's this kind of ineluctable logic that is going to take us all to some version of liberal democracy. That was wrong. It was always wrong. You know, there's a very famous story that when the Constitution is devised, and of course it was written in secret, Benjamin Franklin is being carried out of the Constitutional Convention, and he's asked, what kind of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? And his answer is, a republic, if you can keep it. And I think that there's a, you know, profound point there, that, you know, the kind of sort of systems of government that everybody in this room prizes and for the most part live under, these are always going to be contested, and they are endangered in many, many ways, by everything from Vladimir Putin to, in a different, very different way, TikTok. We're now back in the real world after, you know, an extended Great Picnic.
This is something we've talked a lot about, and I think is now becoming, thankfully, more accepted, that the lazy reading of the end of history, that progress comes automatically, that teleological reading that, Tim, you mentioned before, that this is a natural conclusion of human evolution, that has really fallen away. The scales have fallen from our eyes on that. But I think it's important to draw out something from what you said at the very beginning of your remarks there, is that it was a process of ordering. There wasn't just this order that came. And in order to enact that ordering, we had to embrace our ordering power and actually understand the sources of that power. And that's something I think we've been afraid to do more recently, or unable to do. And we think we really need to overcome that. So how do we marshal those sources of our power, and what are they?
I'm an academic, so I was completely fascinated about this discussion on the world that we are living in. But and last year, the Leonard Marys conference was about, so life begins, so begins new life. But
Incipit vita nova, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. But this year, I mean, it's not by chance for sure that we are saying that let's not despair, but especially let's act. Because I think it's, of course, as an academic, again, it's very useful to discuss all these and try to define what kind of strategic environment are we living in. But mostly we have to focus on how to respond, how to act, how to combine this unprecedented security environment that combines conventional and unconventional threats, and also conventional and unconventional answers. How can we reply? How can we address our concerns? And no matter if you are Portugal or in Estonia, but how can you address the national concerns when we are living an unprecedented year? I mean, we are in a few weeks, we are voting for the European Parliament elections. We have other major elections until the end of the year. And we have the biggest threats that we ever had, probably, if we compare 2019, the previous year of the European elections parliament. I mean, we are living for sure in a post-pandemic world, in a post-Ukraine world, and it's unprecedented, the catalogue of threats that we are facing. So how can we also prepare our societies for the world that we are living now, in 2024? How can we face and how can we reply to this catalogue of threats that seems that don't stop? It's recruitment and radicalization in terms of terrorism, it's piracy, is maritime insecurity, is hybrid, is cyber threats, is disinformation, economic insecurity, global pandemics, climate change. I mean, so many unprecedented threats. So what are we going to do? What are we going to, how are we going to act to actually address this unprecedented security environment? That's my concern, at
least. Well, you're right. And this is the danger of being overwhelmed by that catalogue of threats that you've just outlined. But one country that's not given into despair, Margus, is Estonia. And your Fit for Freedom agenda is exactly an effort to harness the sources of our power in that way and to find a cohesive way of overcoming them. Tell us a bit more about that.
The details you can find on the webpage of Foreign Ministry. But the case is that I was asking when I entered the office a year ago, that how can we describe actually what we are doing as a Foreign Ministry of Estonia? What is our foreign policy? So we are doing many things. We are doing just a couple of days ago, we adopted the law of frozen assets the first time ever in European Union. We are going to prove that it is possible. There's no excuse not to use the frozen assets of Russia because of the rule of law. Let's see what is going to happen. I just read the news that the leader of the Chechen people, or the group actually, announced that now we will wait the missile attack from Chechnya to Estonia because of this law. And we are talking about accountability, we are talking about the values, we are talking about many things, but how can we put it all together with a slogan? And I ask the question, and we ask the question now from everybody globally, whether we are fitting into the freedom or not. Fit for freedom is the question. And what I wanted to point it out as well, that we must make now decisions whether we are going to protect democracy and the way of life what we have, or whether not. And I think this is now that the time is over, in the meaning of just enjoying all these results, what we actually agreed after the last huge conflict. It was the Second World War. We agreed after that these rules and agreements, but these are not working anymore. In the meaning, they're working for us, but I think that the world will be more divided than ever before between the democracies and non-democracies. And we just cannot wait that. Let's see what is going to happen. So we need to act as well. The second thing is that about the hopes and expectations and actually disappointments. About this Georgia example, I remember very well. I was very active as well at this time supporting Georgia when Georgia wanted to move forward to European Union and NATO. It was before 2008. And it was our decision altogether not to give the MAP or whatever we call. And it is the most dangerous place actually for any country as a neighboring country of Russia to sit in the waiting room of NATO. This is the green light for Russia to act. So what I'm saying with that is that we cannot hesitate anymore. We cannot hesitate. We have been hesitating too many times, and the price for these nations has been very high. And the last question for us, I mean, as a democratical world, is that whether we are just keeping these lines, which are secured by the military power as well as NATO, about democracies. I mean that the European Union and so on, not enlarging anymore. Saying that, okay, it's here, we are ready to defend, and we don't care about the other part of the world. We don't care about the Georgians, actually. We don't care about Ukrainians, and let's protect our club. But this is not right, because we will be next under the aggressions and so on. That's the reason why we need to act to protect our way of life, and actually the way of life actually people wants to live.
We heard from Prime Minister Kallas earlier today, some of us at a media briefing, that, quote, we still need to believe in Ukraine's victory. And that's a part of exactly what's at stake here.
Adding shortly, of course we need to believe, but we need to act as well. I read as
yes,
well this
well,
letter.
And this
we
is
need
what
to act. And the case is that, we were like, we have to like think tanks and we have analyses and everything that, 20 years, what is actually Putin wants to do? What is actually behind his words? But this is in the meaning of a critical situation. Putin announced his plan already years ago publicly. Yes, publicly said that, yes, I'm going to restore the emperor of Soviet Union, whatever it costs. And we didn't believe in. We just were hoping that, no, but what is actually behind that? But he's just committing the plan, official plan on the table publicly. All the web pages are full of this plan. So let's believe what his plan is and let's act. That's my case.
Indeed. I mean, Putin has never made a secret about what his aims actually are. We always wonder if there's some big strategy behind it, but he's very clear about what he wants and we need to act as if, as you say. To do that, to really get to action and to really go for victory, and Elliot, I'd like to come to you on that because you've written about victory and its importance. But first, we need to break the cycle of pessimism, I think. This is also one of the reasons I brought up the Prime Minister's remarks earlier, believing in victory, because if we don't believe, we don't act. It leads to inaction. And you brought up the Estonian Parliament's law on seizing Russian assets to support Ukraine. I think that is one way to break this this vicious cycle of pessimism that we seem to be in. There are, of course, other ways to do that. So I'd like to hear from all of our panelists about where that starts. Elliot, let's come to you about this about breaking the cycle of pessimism for victory.
So, I mean, the first thing is let's remind ourselves that the coalition that supports Ukraine has infinitely more resources than Russia, even to the extent that it's backed by China, overwhelmingly, indisputably. And it's just a question of mobilizing them. Secondly, it's important to, at a time when the news and the battlefield isn't that good, or is actually not good at all, remind ourselves there are areas where, there are great successes. In fact, just today, Novorossiysk just took a pummeling from Ukrainian drones. Let's remember that. Let's remember that, you have a bigger NATO with the addition of two very effective members. So first, I think, you need to just take a deep breath, and particularly in a war when, people go through these mood swings, because that does happen in every war, step back and say, well, what's the real balance of resources? But I think the point after, and I also think it is very important to think about concrete actions. Confiscating those Russian assets, absolutely. Giving the Ukrainians authority to use weapons supplied by the West in the territory of Russia is another. Increasing the quantity and quality of the things we give them, that includes a lot more ATACMS from the United States. It includes Taurus from Germany.
Thank you, Elliot,
things.
For our German listeners out there, and a big hello to the Kanzleramt.
Yeah. They know who I'm talking about. But I think the third thing, which I think I really want to dwell on, is it is natural and appropriate and easy for us to talk about how do we support Ukraine. The harder part of the discussion is talking about how do we defeat Russia? Because it's not just a question of victory for Ukraine. It has to be a defeat for Russia. The Russians are going to have to throw in the towel. The Russians are going to have to decide this is not worth it. And that, I will defer to people with greater expertise on Russia than I have. I strongly suspect that it'll be very hard for that to happen with Putin still in power. I tend to think that will only happen when Russian armies suffer not just heavier losses, even heavier losses than they're suffering now, but really major reverses. So in other words, concrete things that happen on the battlefield are going to be key to this. And so a lot of it comes back to very mundane questions of, what kinds of arms supplies, what kinds of training, all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. And there's been questions raised recently about whether we should not only be using NATO air defense assets based in NATO countries to close the skies over Western Ukraine, but to use that shield in order to actually allow us to send in a military training mission of sufficient size that would allow the Ukrainians to regenerate their forces in a significant way to prepare to go on the attack in 2025. I would like to give it a last word to each of our panelists before we then open up to your comments and questions. So do be thinking about what your concise, punchy, short interventions from the floor will be. But first, we're going to come to Tim, and then Anna and Margus for your last words of this first part of the discussion. Tim, please.
I think the question beautifully frames it. If you think of victory, then you start to think about the things you can do. And then when you think about the things you can do, that reinforces the probability of victory. I'm just restating now points that have already been made. My own little additions would be, number one, history. Nothing is ever completely unprecedented. And one thing we have a lot of precedent for is Russia losing wars. They've lost a lot of wars in the last two centuries in every form. And since 1945, the imperial side has generally lost. And since 1945, the smaller country has usually beaten the bigger country. So those are sort of reassuring things that history can remind you of. Number two, this might seem out of left field, but social media reform is very important. Because a lot of the pessimism is artificially generated. The nihilists are coming at us from a mechanized source rather than from human beings. And the people who are behind that are trying to make us feel depressed, right? That is all engineered. And you can only respond to that by reforming social media. Third, one has to, going back to, I think, the very big theme of this conversation, one has to privilege ethics over psychology. When you realize that people are trying to make you feel bad, you have to remember what it is that you think is good, like what it is that you value, what it is you're actually aiming for. And then related to that is human involvement. In addition to all of the things that Eliot said, all of which I agree with, about what America could do and is not doing, we just don't have enough people there. And I don't mean necessarily soldiers on the ground. It's a very weird war in that we don't have enough human contact with Ukrainians, and they don't have human contact with us. And that leads to unnecessary suspicion and unnecessarily limited conversations. And after 2.5 years, we really need to have a lot more people physically there. That will improve everybody's mood. And then the final thing is action versus reaction. Because if you're in a reactive mode, you're also in a reactive mode psychologically. And the other side is very good at putting you in that reactive mode and making you feel down. Whereas if you have actions that you're going to roll out anyway, regardless of what happens, then you're going to feel better about how things are actually going. So like have plans, things that you're just going to be doing regardless of what the news is that day.
Yes, absolutely. And you can read both more from both Eliot and Tim in the pieces that are linked to in our show notes to the live audience that will come, obviously, for the recorded edition, about victory and also about the different ways to achieve it. But indeed, the goal defines the means. And unless we set that goal, which, as we know, Chancellor Olaf Scholz has not done, among other leaders who have not done that, you won't define the means necessary to achieve it. Anna.
Yeah, we must define the goal and we must define what victory means, first of all, for the Ukrainians. And that is part of the role of Ukraine to define what victory is politically and militarily. But I would also add that, optimist victory is, of course, and should emanate, first of all, from the trust that we must have that we can make ourselves stronger and tackle any challenges in our path. And I think that we do have reasons to be optimist, especially if we look to the recent months, both in NATO and European Union. I think it's always important to emphasize the importance of the European Union strategic compass, the NATO strategic concept, because in fact, and also the path that we are striving towards the Washington summit, because it's always important to realize how we are banding together in support of Ukraine. Our support remains live, kicking, and I would say growing every day in very solid terms. But we have to identify our vulnerabilities, our threats, our challenges, and create also new instruments to deal with them. And I would say, just to conclude, that I believe that our hope should also be inclusive. We should reach out to our partners in a 360-degree approach. The Partners for a Better Vision, for a better, more secure and prosperous world. And again, Portugal can play a very important role bridging these concerns with our southern partners, with Africa, but also with Brazil, and bridge also with America. But of course, a lack of optimism and a lack of vision for victory is always a powerful driver for insecurity and instability. So we must avoid that scenario.
Absolutely. And speaking of different definitions of victory, you can read, as I say, Eliot, who's written a number of things on what this means, contrast them perhaps to what Jack Watling recently wrote in Foreign Affairs, more we need to put Ukraine in a position to negotiate from a position of strength. Now, that's not enough for a lot of people around this room, but the analysis is there, it is doing the rounds, it is interesting, and it's based on expertise. So this is a conversation we need to have, and we need to make that case. But Margus, just coming to what Anna said, this notion of a more inclusive order is part of your Fit for Freedom agenda, but more inclusive can't mean anything goes. It has to serve the interests of democracies, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, but I like your question you asked as well, the psychological part of what will happen in the future. This is actually a decision question. It's the first is actually, what is the goal? And we have not agreed in the Western world that our goal is to win this war. We have not done it. We must just decide it that we have to win, then we are going to have a plan, and then we need to act. So, but we haven't done it, be honest. We haven't done it. We are talking about it. And the reason is that we are afraid of winning the war with Russia. And we are afraid, actually, what will happen if Russia lose this war. We are so much afraid of that. And we are not ready, actually, for that. But I say, and not we, I can say in the name of Estonia that we are not afraid of, I think that Russia must lose this war. But this is the main mental question. The second thing is that the lack of leadership amongst us. Be honest, if we are waiting months and months and months and watching very, 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 very closely the debates in US about $61 billion package, not about the decision whether to win or not the war, but about $61 billion. So this is the weakness from our part of the world and democracies. So the lack of leadership, I'm not talking about the persons, is it like Scholz, Macron, Biden, whoever, but the lack of leadership. Because societies are more or less ready to support it. But there is another concern. I've made these kind of examples that, you know, this communication very personal. And nowadays we are like ordering the war movies from Netflix and the other parts. So, and then war movies normally like 2.5 hours. So, but I think that for our people globally, it's the feeling is like that, okay, this 2 hours and 15 minutes already. So I would like to see another movie. So let's finish this. Let's just, you know, the heroes and who's winning, who's losing, and let's put it away. And maybe I would like to have another topic, not a war movie anymore, maybe just comedy. And this mentality is bad because even the news today at this time, this conference, I think that there may be thousands of people from Russian side, from Ukrainian side, they're dead. And these are not the news anymore. This business as usual, because we would like to watch the comedy instead of the war movie. But the bad thing is that this situation is not a war movie. It's not the movie from Netflix. It's reality. And that's and politicians, instead of leadership, we are following what people wants to get, because in democracies people says what they want to get. But in situation we need to have a leadership who says that what we must do. That's like we have elections, like half of the world will have elections this year. And this is actually a test about the leadership, not even about the people, but leadership.
The elections are a good reminder that, yes, indeed, elections are about leadership and democracy is about leadership. Before we come to the audience, one last word to Elliot about victory, because I think you really wanted to come in there.
I apologize because I have to leave, unfortunately. But first, I completely, totally applaud what was just said. On Jack Wadling, I'll point out, he was also profoundly pessimistic about Ukraine's chances before the war began. And there is a long strain of pessimism about Ukraine and its chances, which continues to persist and which saps our will. And the last thing I'll say is to just quote my favorite psychologist, William James, who said, "You don't do brave things because you have brave feelings. You have brave feelings when you do brave things." And the country that is hosting us is actually a pretty good example of that. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Elliot. A round of applause for Elliot Cohen, ladies and gentlemen. So the free-for-all begins. Get your hands up in there if you'd like to ask a question, and we'll make sure a mic comes to you.
I see this first initiative over here.
But do please keep your questions short. Introduce yourself very briefly. And it can also be a comment as well as a question, just to be clear.
Yes.
But short and punchy.
Thank you. I'm from Georgia. I'm Zurab Chebrashvili, representing the party Saakashvili founded in early 2000s. And we are two here from Georgia, two former diplomats and ambassadors to various places in Europe. And we both knew 12 years ago when Ivanishvili came to power that we will come to this point. What I would like to comment on, the panel, this fantastic panel was absolutely right. But about Georgia, I would summarize. First, Mr. Minister, thank you very much. I was in the crowd when you've been addressing the rally, and thank you very much what you and other ministers did. I already voiced our thanks to your prime minister yesterday, and I will be repeating that all the time. The regime, Ivanishvili regime in Georgia, they have to destroy democracy in order to change foreign policy. That's the crucial. Because when 85% of people support EU and NATO integration. You have to destroy democracy first and then reverse the foreign policy. The key message from our side would be the following. If Ukraine would be offensive now, Ivanishvili would not dare to reintroduce the law, would not dare to destroy the Georgian democracy. The problem is that there is interconnection between Ukraine and Georgia. The Ivanishvili, with the offensive of Russia, saw that opportunity, that window of opportunity, that now is the time to break Georgia and to make the Georgia just a vassal of Russia. And the last point, I represent political party. What the regime is telling to Georgian people is the following. What you want, be happy that Russian bombs are not falling on your heads. And from the opposition side, it's very difficult to reply to that message. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We had a question here as well. And then one at the back, the lady in the blue. First of all, the gentleman here. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Mark Champion. I'm a columnist with Bloomberg. I slightly worry that, here, the message of, we need to be inspired and have hope for liberalism, democracy, and so on. That message works really well here. It works actually quite very well in Georgia, where people are struggling, know what they want. And the EU is actually an inspiring idea. What we see in the United States and in parts of Europe, I fear, is that that message is not necessarily working because we don't actually know as collective societies which values we're actually fighting over those values. And if, you know, the election in the United States is a pretty good example where there's parts of the country which agree with Putin on a lot of the sort of value issues and so on. And that, so if we, I wonder if we shouldn't, and I get, this is a question actually, should we not base the case that we're making to Americans, to, you know, people in Europe, more on interests, more on, well, let's tell you what does happen if Russia wins. Let's tell you what the costs are. Let's, you know, be much more explicit about the relative costs that you are experiencing now and the ones that you would pay in the future. And a little less on, you know, let's fight for democracy, because we're not quite there yet.
Really interesting question. And just a quick remark while the mic's making its way to the lady at the back in the blue. Of course, following German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, we could consider if our values are our interests, if there's not actually a distinction between those things. And by pursuing our values as interests, we take care of the other side of that coin. That's, of course, a neo-idealist point of view, but there are other ways. And we'll be hearing from the panel about that in a second. Please, to the back.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. Reelika Veronen, Estonian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. As a very short intro, I had the honor of interviewing Mr. Snyder in November 2019 in Tallinn after the MAUEFOL 30 conference. And it was a completely different world looking back at the interview. But some of the topics that we discussed also included the Russian disinformation and propaganda and how it is tearing people, societies and countries apart. So my question for Mr. Snyder and the whole round, and it was also discussed in the opening panel yesterday. So it's on one hand a very, very difficult and maybe also a naive question, but Russia is putting probably billions into their propaganda all over Europe, influencing us. How do we fight it? How do you see the fight against disinformation? And maybe from also an Estonian perspective, if you try to speak here or try to speak to the people who are influenced directly by reading Russian media, their main argument is, oh, well, you Europeans have your own propaganda. So they don't see it as evidence-based truth or the, so to say, propaganda truth. But just a very broad question, how do we fight this together for not letting us tear our societies apart?
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed for that. Let's come straight to Tim on that. I mean, you talked earlier about mechanized nihilism as this way of destabilizing exactly regimes of truth and so on. Would you like to respond to that? And also to the question on values and interests, I think it would be very interesting to hear from you. And then also Margus from you and from Anna on the questions and comments that were raised. So Tim, please.
Sure. So beginning at the highest level and returning to the theme of values, I don't think we can do without the value of truth. I don't think we can do without it, because if you accept the premise that there isn't any truth, then you don't have any argument against the person who says, well, I have my propaganda and you have your propaganda. And of course, that is the basic Russian epistemic, that there is no truth and we're better at lying than you are, and therefore we win. And also, since there is no truth, we're actually morally superior to you, because we're not hypocritical. We don't pretend that we're telling the truth, right? So therefore, we're actually better than you because you're the hypocrites. And of course, if you accept the premise that there's no truth, then you are a hypocrite and they're right. So you have, I think one has to have, you know, this apparently naive thing, which people have a hard time with now, which is that we are actually looking for some kind of truth. At the other end of the argument is that you have to have humans who are pursuing factual reality. So to take the example of Georgia, I mean, a small part of the tragedy in Georgia is there just aren't enough Americans, reporters in general, writing about it, right? And so for in order to make Americans to pay attention, one has to like retweet something. And, you know, one does that, but we just don't have the repertorial resources that we had in the 1980s. We just don't. And that has to be subsidized. Like, we have to say, this is a good. It's a public good. We have to subsidize this. And this actually begins at home, because, I mean, you don't, if you're going to have a regime of truth, it has to begin with, is there mercury in the water? You know, is my local mayor corrupt? And if you have it there, then you'll also maybe have it in the foreign reporters as well. And then in the middle is what I mentioned before, which is regulating social media so that the people who are mechanizing the lying don't have the advantage of gravity, which they do now. The way it's not, TikTok is bad, but it's not just TikTok. It's all of them. It's the ones in California too. It's basically the same. They have gravity on their side. So the Russians are taking advantage of the way that the institution is actually set up. And then on this question of values, I mean, I quite accept the premise of the question. There's a lot of idealization of tyranny in the United States, including idealization of a particular tyrant. And some of it is sincere. And if we did have tyranny in the U.S., a lot of these people would be very happy. And some of it, though, is just based on a naive notion of what it would be like to have a strong man, because we've never had one, right? And so people think, oh, this would be great. And so part of what one has to do is explain how life is dismal when your neighbor is informing on you, and how life is dismal when, like, you have to pay a bribe to go to the doctor, and these, like, everyday things. Because I imagine that the strong man is going to be their strong man, and then suddenly everything's going to be easy in their lives, you know, which it's, you know, that's maybe an understandable impulse. And then on the other side of it, and I think the recent Polish experience is on this side, you have to show that democracy delivers things, that there are things that you care about that you can get in the future with democracy. And those may have to do with rights and freedoms. And so, because it does, you're right. I think this is your view, and you can correct me, but the word democracy actually doesn't excite anybody in the U.S. except the people who are already excited, right? Like, that's the truth, right? You have to explain what it is that tyranny would make worse, and also how democracy is going to bring things about in the future. Okay, so I'll leave it there.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I think it's a really important question. It also relates to the disinformation point, because if democracy is not actually delivering on its claim to both material as well as moral superiority that is tangible to enough of our people, that creates the problem of belief. It also creates the cracks in which disinformation can work and take root and take hold. So we have to be able to address that. So I think it's a really important question to ask. But with Tim on this, I don't think you can do without the values.
You were reminding me, of course, of Arendt's famous quote about the goal of totalitarianism. It's not actually to convince you to be, you know, a proper fascist or a communist. It is to basically make you not care about the truth or be apathetic about the truth, which is why I think if we bring this back to values versus interests, you know, one of our values is the truth and one of our interests is obviously also the truth. So to come back to Baerbock which Ben was referring to earlier, the German foreign minister, her point about this very bluntly was that the distinction between values and interests were total crap. Direct quote from the German foreign minister. So let's ask both Anna and Margus to come in on this question about this. Is there a difference? Can we pursue these at once, or do we pursue one and the other at the same time? How does this work?
It's a very tricky question, this one of should we look at values and interests as complete different concepts and completely aside from each other. It's a very interesting question. So I would say that values are nothing if they are not part of a bigger and wider package. When we look to values and we look at democracy and we look at security, principles and values in general, of course. But at the same time, you must have interest. You have to enter, you have to be geopolitical. And that's probably one of the gaps that we can identify in our liberal democracies at this moment, is that we are not being geopolitical enough, starting by the European Union. I always like to remind a famous quote from Borrell when he presented the strategic compass. He said, the European Union must learn to speak the language of power. So there was that was a very geopolitical statement that led or paved the way to be more strategically in terms of autonomy. But I think it really has to do with that. I mean, democracy, liberal democracy is nothing if we don't feel that the most valuable deliverable of democracy is security. And principles and values are very important, but we must be aware that we also have interests and we must be more geopolitical on this. So I would argue that to start with. Just a very brief comments on the other two questions on the propaganda and disinformation. I would say that a roadmap is ongoing, both with NATO and the European Union. But again, I would like to emphasize that we need to have a threefold approach. We have to anticipate, we have to protect and be more resilient, and we have to have a lessons learned. These are the three ideas that I think are very important to actually counter what propaganda and disinformation means nowadays. And to conclude, I also would like to address a word to our Georgian fellows. Portugal is very clear on this. We fully support the European and Western aspirations of Georgia, and we fully encourage the reforms within the Copenhagen criteria and the acquis communautaire. So we wish you all the best, and we hope to have Georgia with us in the future very soon.
Margus, hope alone won't get us through that. We have to make it credible hope, right? And how do we go
credible
about doing that?
Or incredible. Credible?
Credible.
Yeah. So about this discussion, and there are a value-based policy, and then there is a like different world when we have like practical policy. And I think that it has been a big mistake all over the decades, that the way of thinking like this. And the proof of that is that actually the value-based policy is very practical, because it is existential. Because without these values, we cannot be practical as well. Because without that, we couldn't have any kind of the lifestyle as we're enjoying right now. Is it a very practical way of being on that level of the incomes and then the freedoms and the personal rights? And also, be honest, to be so happy personally in the meaning of what the standards of living we're having in democratic countries. And as well in this fit for freedom, what we're saying mainly is that these countries which are respecting the personal rights and democracies and the personal, the liberal values in the meaning, these countries are not as well aggressive against the others. So actually, this is, it's coming finally, it is very personal how people are feeling. So that's why I wanted to say as well that this value-based policy is very practical. It's existential. And just now we are witnessing that we have to fight and stand for that in very practical ways. But the fight is not only in Ukraine, in the meaning, and in Gaza and some other parts, military ways, but also the main fight is about the people's mind. It's about the people's mind. And it is based about the two big things. And what we are affected, that the humans are like sex and the fear of death. Putin is not playing about the sex, using that. But he's using the fear. and personally, and as a countries, as a nations. So escalating the personal fears and fears of the nations, the leaders of the nations, and so fears of, I don't know, escalation and whatever. If we are about this US situation, if we are following, what are the number one topics? Not, of course, the democracy in the world, the global democracy. It's about immigration. It's the first thing. And immigration is not because of immigration, but because of fear about the, you know, and then economical questions. This is personal fear as well. How can I pay my loans? How can I survive and so on? And this is all these kind of things. So they're based on the fear. And this is we have to understand as well. And even why we have not decided to win the war and why we are afraid about what is going to happen when Russia is losing the war is that we are afraid of escalation. And we don't know even what this escalation is. We think that, okay, nuclear war is the escalation. And we are so much afraid about that. So fear, and fear is in our minds. Fear is not like a very practical thing. So.
No, exactly. Tim, you wanted to come in on just that.
Yeah, just briefly, that's a bit, you've recharacterized in a very nice way what I was trying to say about ethics versus psychology. Because you can't be a realist without being an idealist first. Because if you don't know what your ideals are, you can't be a realist in pursuing them. And if you don't have ideals, then your notion of interests collapses into what I was trying to call psychology, but what you're calling fear. So if you don't have ideals, then what you confuse your interests with how somebody has just manipulated you into being afraid. Right. And if that happens to you again and again and again, then you're not really capable of making any sort of foreign policy, but you believe that you are. And the escalation cliche is a wonderful example of this, right? Like the American fear of nuclear war or of migration or whatever. It's an example of how a subject where we would be thinking more clearly if we had values becomes a morass of this kind of mindless angst because we've put the values aside and we confuse our interests with how we're just feeling. And unfortunately, how we are feeling, it goes back to your question, is very often how we're being made to feel.
Right. And this notion somehow that values-based policy is wishy-washy or doesn't have a hard edge is wrong. It's simply wrong. You have to be able to pursue those values in a meaningful, hard-edged way. And putting those first gives you the guide to then develop the means to do so. Aaron.
On that, you said earlier that the most important, you know, guarantee that a democracy can give is security. But then if, you know, that's not simply a statement. That an example of that comes directly to what you said, that democracies don't fight each other. So pursuing democracy, spreading democracy, that is also a way of actually pursuing our interests simply because it secures us, you know, against each other. I'd like to come again to the audience for a few more questions over here at this center table.
Thank you. Marek Aisk from the Estonian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So I actually have a question about like narratives of democracy. So whether we're talking about the end of history, already mentioned here today, or politics of inevitability, there's all of these narratives that democracy has won already or it will win. So we can, of course, speculate whether these narratives have actually caused the backsliding that we see right now in the world of democracy. But my question is actually, do we need a new narrative for democracies? Or is that what kind of got us into trouble in the first place?
I do love this question. Do we have another to collect right over here? There we go.
I'm from Italy, Sergio Germani. I'm a scholar of observer of Russian affairs. But I'd like to ask you a broader question. It's obvious that liberal democracy is under intellectual attack from various quarters, right? Putinism, China, populism, big tech. We don't know. It's ambiguous. So there's a kind of multidimensional threat, intellectual threat. Do you think there could be a grand strategy to defend liberal democracy, as there was during the Cold War? There was a strategy of influence, of cultural influence during the Cold War to discredit totalitarianism, communism, and to uphold democracy. Do you think that today we can imagine some kind of grand strategy to defend intellectually and culturally liberal democracy?
Thank you. While we see the mic passed for the next question, just to note that in Berlin, we're actually setting up a thing called the Democratic Strategy Initiative to develop exactly this, based on initially neo-idealist principles, but also open to other competing ways of doing that, to marshal the sources of our power in order to actually direct them for our interests and values, which we see as being highly united together across themes of community cohesion through military readiness, effective internationalism, reforming our system, and reconsidering how we harness both the dynamism of free people, but also the way we share that prosperity inside our society. So to address some of those cracks, that's really the task we are setting ourselves to. So watch this space for more on that. Next question, please.
Yes, thank you. Allan from Estonian Government Office. And I'm also like continuing this grand narrative or strategy question that in real life, we also have many non-democratic countries that are allied to democratic countries. We are very much centered in this discussion with how to defend the liberal order. But in reality, since the Second World War, the liberal order is very dependent on non-democratic or non-liberal countries. We need hydrocarbons from Azerbaijan. We need relations with Turkey. We need like diplomatic relations with many African countries, and etc. So this is like how to get this large narrative or strategy that is beyond democratic, or like a bit more inclusive, because in the Cold War we had anti-communism, but now we don't have this.
I'd like to come to this point quickly and then take one more question. And the reason why I want to come to this is I'm from Canada, of course, and I look a lot at the sort of the trade numbers and economic links that exist between Canada and Europe. And Europe buys less than $4 billion in critical minerals, for example, from Canada. Canada is the largest producer in the world of 9 critical minerals. I mean, so this is a scandalously low figure. And I think that that also speaks to the need to link up our democracies in a new strategic way. And that's very, very much a part of this.
Just on LNG, exactly. We wouldn't have to buy it from Azerbaijan if we leveraged the fact we could buy it from Canada. There's options out there. We've not chosen them. That's part of the point. And understanding how we can make those options available for action so we don't despair is a key element of this. Last question over there, please.
Hi, I'm Inês Ribeiro from the Portuguese Ministry of Defense. So a few years ago, I know that NATO was working on something related to democratic resilience, like sort of a center. And I was wondering what the panel thinks of this idea, because essentially what we're seeing is security no longer being just physical, but also ontological. So protecting this community of values. So I'd like to see your opinion on that. Thanks.
Anna, let's come to you for a 2-minute response here, because I saw you nodding your head there about this particular question.
No, I mean, it will be my last statement, I assume. So I'll try to be very, very quick. And starting with the first question, do we need a new bottle for old wine? I don't think so. Not just for makeup, no. But still, it's important to go to the roots. And when we go to the root of the liberal democracy, what it's enshrined is that democracy implies security, that implies development, and so on. So democracy, security, and development always were perceived as being part of the same package. And when we go to the roots again, for instance, in the United Nations, we clearly acknowledge that this debate, this narrative, starts in 1994 with the United Nations Development Programme, when they assume and they include the concept of human security as part of the United Nations narrative, distinguishing the freedom from fear, the freedom from want. But again, democracy implies security, security implies development, and development implies all the rest. So it was in 1994, probably in 2024, we would include Marga's fear of escalation as well, which is a very good idea also to go through this debate. Then also a very quick word on a grand strategy to defend democracies, and I believe that's also related with this last question on the democratic resilience. I would say that we don't need to reinvent anything in general. We just need to make it work what it really exists. And we need to go through the multilateral organizations like the EU, NATO, United Nations. They are all based in a community of values and principles. So I think it's up to all our nations to actually make these liberal democracies work in the forums that already exist. And of course, it's very important that we find new initiatives like the one of the democratic resilience, but making things really worth and make the international organizations really work in practice. Do not reinvent anything.
As Margus, you were writing about in The Guardian just last December, which we'll link to in our show notes. But please, your two-minute last statement.
Yeah, I'm trying to cover the narrative talk. It was a very, very good question. Should we do we need a new narrative? No, of course. The case is it's not about what we are talking about. The case is that what kind of life we are living. That's the case. I think people are interested about living their life that they can be happy, they can be rich, they can be loved, and so on. And the bad thing is that, you know, I've been thinking of why we are in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, these countries who actually, geopolitically, we are very close to Russia as well, why we are supporting and understanding actually Ukraine more than maybe some others. And why we are understanding as well that these values and, are very important. You know, because we were occupied 50 years. We're still remembering what does it feel to live without freedom. These stories are real in our families. So we know the price of freedom. And what I want to say is, well, that maybe I'm wrong and I hope I'm wrong. There has been very long time in Europe, at least the peace time. You know, we don't remember anymore how does it feel to live without freedom. What does the war really mean? Ukrainians are now having this experience, and this is tragical. So, and I really do hope that we can learn from different kind of ideas, and we can name whatever the narratives. But the question is that whether we have to pay the price and then to react. We agreed this law of order and these agreements after the Second World War, when we paid a huge price. We could actually act in 1941 or even before 1940 or 39 actually, but we didn't do it. We didn't do it because at this time, business as usual thinking was there. Maybe it's going away. I think that right now we are somewhere maybe in, I don't know, 1940, 41 or something like this. My question is how much must be the price that we finally will react, that people are understanding, not, you know, normal people are not thinking in the morning, waking up that, do I live in democracy or is it like the liberal democracy or whatever it is? They're thinking about how can I be happy, enjoy the economical wealth, be together with my family and live in peace. You know, that's the case. And I'm so afraid of that we are not acting the right way, and we are not going to act before the price is already here and we need to pay that. And then it's too late. That's the case.
But then the value of narratives and slogans, as you called it before, in concentrating minds and concentrating actions is why we come up with something like Fit for Freedom, to say actually this encapsulated, it doesn't dumb it down. It's why peace through strength was an effective rallying point towards the end of the Cold War.
Actually, the Fit for Freedom concept is a practical guidebook. It's not theoretical thing.
Well, that's the point. It has to motivate practical action. Tim, for your closing remarks, please.
Yeah, I want to try to pick up the ontological question and connect it to the narrative question, but I want to do so by returning to your question, in fact, because when I'm trying to communicate with Americans about what it would be like to lose the rule of law, I talk to them about children, because it's one of the non-obvious things, and it's something that speaks to people. It really is different when you have to arrange all of your life decisions around fear of what's going to happen to your kids, which is, for example, the Russian norm. If you're always concerned that something you're going to do means that your kid's going to get thrown out of school or not go to college or lose their jobs. And Russians, just to take the Russian example, have to think about those things all the time. And it's very easy to move into a world of unfreedom where that's what you're thinking about all the time. Not about how your kid is going to fall in love and get rich, but about how something bad is going to happen to your kid because you stepped out. You did some little thing. This soft American example leads me to this conference is already a success for me because you used the word ontological. But into this question of being, because I think being free really is a different way of being alive. Those 20,000, and it's more, but those 20,000 Ukrainian children, if they are raised in Russia, they will have qualitatively different lives than if they were raised in Ukraine. That's just the case. They're going to grow up different sorts of people than they would have otherwise. And and the only way to take this seriously is to recognize that. Now, that's a sharp example, but it's a true example. Of the fact that you really are in a different world when you're trying to design something towards the future for freedom, which brings me to the narrative question. There are a couple of words, and I don't mean this in a hostile way, but there are a couple of words that I think we should just drop and try to express our thoughts without them, and they are escalation and narrative. I think if we could like have a whole conference where no one used either of those words, we would all be happier, smarter people. But with narrative, the chief problems are that the problems for freedom are stories which have zero future, which would be a Trump or a Putin. There's no future. It's all cycling back to an imagined past, or one future, which is communism or the end of history, right? We're all going to end up in this happy place because the economics are going to push us there. Right, which is what Stalin said. It's also what Silicon Valley says, right? That it has to end up in a certain way because the economy, because changes in the modes of production. And the problem with having one future is that when it turns out it's not true, right? And Silicon Valley is just as wrong as Brezhnev. When it turns out that it's not true, then you lose faith. Then you're in despair. So what we don't need is a narrative. What we need is a horizon of individual possibilities, right? We need the sense that democracy makes it possible for individuals, families, small groups to do the things they want to do and make a better future all along the way, which brings me to culture. So, I mean, the thing, like back when I'm looking around to see if like I recognize any Americans here, but like back when we were smart, I'm just
identify
now. I know who's an American. But back when we were smart, the thing that we didn't say like American culture is great. What we said was, here's Jackson Pollock, you know, here's some African Americans performing jazz. That's what we did. And that's the sort of thing you do, right? You don't say like America's great or Canada's great or whatever, or Belgium is great. You say, here's some art, like here's a translation of a book, you know, that. And we actually, I think, have a greater disproportion of cultural power than we did in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, because the cultural superpowers are now South Korea and Japan and America. So countries which are more or less democratic, I say with a certain modesty, right? And those, and so there, I think the possibility, sorry, I should be looking at you when I say all this, but I think the possibility for doing this, I think, is very much there. But the way it works is not saying like we have a great culture. The way it works is to say, look what happens when you're free. You get this cool rap music, you get this cool painting, you get this, you get 1,000 little things as opposed to one big story.
Right. I mean, you don't go out and tell people you're cool. That's the most clear way to tell that you're not, right? So you either are or you aren't. And while democracy might not motivate as a word, freedom certainly does. And the idea of living in freedom, we've heard that from all of our panelists today. We're going to close with just a word from Lennart Meri, who's speaking to an audience in Berlin back in 1995, said, principles gain an importance that does not depend on the physical dimensions of the bearer. And it's up to us. It's our duty to remember these fundamental principles and continually fill them with life. And that is a sentiment that animates this conference. It's a sentiment that's animated this panel. And I think it's one that we can actually take forward to say it doesn't depend indeed on the physical might. Might doesn't make right, much as size doesn't make wise. And we've seen the kind of leadership that we need to see on this, in this particular time, from some of the smaller states in Europe. Now we just need to let them actually lead and give animating life to those ideas.
I absolutely agree. There is always that agenda setting power, which we find here especially, which is so important. So that is a wrap for this special episode of Tallinn Side Out, Berlin Side Out. Thank you all for joining. Thank you to our guests. And a very special deep thanks from us before we go to Lennart Meri Conference Director Helga Kahn for her help putting this together. She was amazing. We could not have done it without her. So a very special shout out to her. From us in Tallinn, thank you. And until next time.
Thank you all.